With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning. Today is Wednesday, October 4th. Coming up in today's show, information on training courses to fulfill part of the produce safety rule. We'll have more on that in a little bit, but first, here is Taylor Hillman.
Groundwater basin recharge projects, like the flooding of agricultural land during winter months, continue to gain interest.
Yeah, at least from what we hear, what the word is on the street.
Helen Dahlke is the lead researcher on the project that's monitoring almond orchards and alfalfa that get 24 inches of runoff surface water in the off-season. Dahlke says groundwater sustainability agencies, which are the groups that are formed in areas to comply with the first step of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, also known as SGMA, have checked in on recharge projects and could use the practice in their long-term plans they have to submit to the state.
Some water district managers have approached us with more detailed questions on, you know, how their GSA members or clients could potentially implement such programs. And so it sounds like there are many GSAs throughout the state that are thinking about some sort of solution to implement managed aquifer recharge projects. And that doesn't necessarily just have to be flooding farm fields, but also other methods such as using infiltration basins, or some even ask about injection wells. So it sounds like there is a pretty broad interest in various methods to replenish groundwater.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Several agriculture groups are expressing support for the Agriculture Guest Worker Act of 2017. The bill would create an H-2C visa program that will allow American farmers and packers and processors access to a legal and stable supply of workers. The National Chicken Council says the bill would help farmers access legal workers to combat workforce shortages. The National Pork Producers Council says the bill, introduced Monday by Virginian Republican Representative Bob Goodlatte, would allow the pork industry access to a viable agriculture workforce to remain globally competitive. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duvall says the bill addresses the needs of agriculture's current workforce. The new program would allow undocumented workers who can demonstrate agriculture work experience over the previous two-year period to get an H-2C visa. An initial cap of 500,000 workers would be allowed under the program, with allowances to adjust the number depending on U.S. agriculture labor demand each year. The North American Free Trade Agreement renegotiation effort will return to Washington, D.C. this month for the fourth round of official talks. The negotiations will resume October 11th through the 15th, following a round of talks in Canada last month. Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs Chrystia Freeland said progress was made in the most recent meetings on a number of bread-and-butter trade issues. Meanwhile, the U.S. has yet to introduce a proposal to increase protections for seasonal and perishable produce. The tabled issue is being closely watched by agriculture groups, including the National Pork Producers Council, which says the proposal could provoke America's NAFTA partners to push for mechanisms that make it easier to restrict U.S. farm exports. By U.S. law and official notice to Congress, the earliest a deal can be agreed upon and concluded is March of next year. But Forbes speculates that would be too close to the midterm election cycle, as a comment period would extend into September 2018, even at the fastest pace, likely putting the potential of final approval of a new NAFTA in 2019. Corn is making good progress toward maturity, but the numbers are still behind the crop's five-year averages, Stephanie Ho reports.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey points to what he describes as a nice jump in corn reaching full maturity.
We're now at 68%, and that, despite the progress in the last several weeks, is 10 percentage points behind the five-year average of 78%, and even more behind last year's 84% on October 1st.
He says good weather has helped speed corn maturity, but that the process was already delayed to start with.
Of course, as the crop matures late, harvest is going to come in behind schedule as producers wait for dry down in the field.
Meanwhile,
not sure of the reason, but corn condition taking a little jump upward for the week ending October 1st, now at 63% good to excellent, up 2 points, and the very poor to poor ratings at 12%, down a point.
He says the late harvest boost still doesn't bring corn close to last year's condition ratings, which were 73% good to excellent and 8% very poor to poor. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The cost of that cup of coffee you're drinking may be more of a bargain than you bargained for. Gary Crawford brews up this report.
Coffee has inspired many songwriters to brew up songs dedicated to it.
I love coffee. I love tea. Shoot me a pot and I'll pour me a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Now, in 1940, when the song was a hit, it might have played on a jukebox in this little coffee shop, and you might have heard this exchange.
I want a cup of coffee.
Okay, Mr. Black.
Just a cup of coffee.
That will be 20 cents, please.
Boing! 20 cents for two cups of coffee, 10 cents a cup, jumpin' Jaffa. Batman, look what we're paying today, you may say. So, you think coffee prices are outrageous today, even to buy a pound of coffee to brew at home? Be prepared then to be a little surprised at the results of a little study done by Agriculture Department analyst Anne Marie Coons. She's comparing the current average price of a 12-ounce cup of coffee made at home to the price when this song was a hit.
Shake down.
1987, using the average cost of a pound of coffee, all types, all prices. Cost for us to brew a cup of coffee at home in 1987, 12.2 cents. Cost today, 19 cents. So about 7 cents higher.
But then if we take 1987 and adjust that cost for inflation, it brings it up to 26.3 cents.
So actually, today's cup of coffee costs about 7 cents less than 30 years ago. And then adding an ounce of whole milk and a teaspoon of sugar to both cups takes the 2017 price up 3 cents to 22.2, but it takes the 1987 cup over 4.5 cents more,
bringing that total inflation-adjusted cost to 30.8 cents.
Making the inflation-adjusted 1987 cup about 8.5 cents higher than today's price. But Anne-Marie was using the average retail prices of a pound of ground coffee, from the cheap to the super expensive, the average. And those prices over the years are all over the map. November 2012, the average pound of coffee was selling for over $6. Average this year is only about $4.50. However, some people pay a lot more. We caught up with coffee grower, importer, and expert Orlando Holmes at Farmer's Market. He sells his bags of coffee grown on his own farm in Honduras, roasted here locally by him in the D.C. area, for about $12 to $13 a pound. But no matter what you pay, you want to get the best quality out of that coffee. And Orlando gave us some advice on how to get the best taste for your coffee dollars. First,
buy the coffee like you're buying bread. Get just enough for a week. But if you've got to have extra reserve coffee, because coffee people don't like to run out of coffee, freeze it.
In an airtight container, it'll stay good for about how long?
3 months.
But unfrozen, just left in the bag, Rhonda Holmes says the coffee will be at peak flavor for only about 3 days after it was roasted.
So after 3 days, you've got it as good as it's going to get. And a week after that, it's going to drop off.
Orlando says if you buy a pound of coffee, any kind, you can help preserve the good quality by doing whatever you can to keep the air away from it. Coffee reacts to oxygen, and the result over time is less quality. So once you open the bag and use some of it, put the rest in an airtight container immediately. Going back into my airtight container, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take "with you" from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
Okay, Mike is calling from Davenport. Go ahead, Mike. You're on Soil Talk.
Yeah, guys. The engine isn't performing like it should,
and I'm wondering what's going on.
All right, couple of questions, Mike. Do you have high porosity in aggregates? Is there a porous medium for gas exchange?
I don't know.
Well, hey, look, Mike, if you want performance, you got to find out if it's good under the hood, huh?
Okay, how?
Now stop by your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today, Mike. They can help you supercharge your soil and get that engine cranking it out for you.
We're out of time, Mike. Hey, thanks for your call. Gotta go. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Soil Talk.
Find out what you can do to maximize your farm's production engine. It's soil. Through soil health management systems, you can lower input costs, increase yields, and drought protect your farm.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
A series of Produce Safety Alliance grower training courses are being offered to fulfill part of the Food Safety Modernization Act's Produce Safety Rule. The rule requires at least one supervisor or responsible party for your farm to complete food safety training recognized by the Food and Drug Administration. And the upcoming grower training courses are the only courses currently recognized by the FDA. The first one will be held on October 25th at the Chez Cherie Banquet Facility in Manteca, followed by November 1st at the Kern County Ag Pavilion in Bakersfield, November 8th at the Lodge at Blue Lake in Upper Lake, and November 13th at the Piccadilly Inn in Fresno. December 3rd will be held at the Hyatt Regency Orange County in Garden Grove, December 8th at the Plaza in Yuba City, and December 12th at the Yolo County Farm Bureau in Woodland. The final training course will be held on December 14th at the San Joaquin County Farm Bureau in Stockton. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Meat Export Federation just completed its U.S. Beef Roadshow in China, a series of marketing events conducting in China's three largest cities. With more on that story, here's Joe Shealy.
The U.S. Meat Export Federation has just completed its U.S. Beef Roadshow in China, highlighting U.S. beef in the country's three largest cities. Senior VP Joel Haggard has more details in this USMEF report.
We thought very early on when we knew beef access was coming that it would be very beneficial to our industry and to our exporter members to come and experience the market. In addition to that, it's obvious that we are able to attract a large number of buyers at each of the three stops we make, one in North China, one in Central China, and one in South China. So the roadshow is really an exhibition of beef exporters, and it's to a closed audience of screened importer candidates and end-user customers. We believe this format is the ideal one to promote U.S. beef exports here and to further the momentum that's already been in the marketplace.
Peter Cho of Topping Cuisine International is a major beef importer in China.
We see the market is starting moving, so we have some major accounts like the most famous steakhouse in Shanghai, the Mortons and Park Hyatt and stuff. They are committed to put U.S. steaks on the menus already. Of course, we understand that there might be some learning curve from the state side, from our side, how to match the requirements here. But we feel confident as time moving and the market will accept more and more U.S. beef.
Evan Wang represents U.S.-based exporter PMI Foods in the region.
One of the questions we have been hearing from the customers in China is where can they get U.S. beef and where they can get consistent supply. So that's why we're here, to explain how much volume, the process, and the grading system of the quality of U.S. beef. I think it's very successful, and we got a lot of inquiries.
For more information, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Shealy.
Thanks, Joe. And when it comes to U.S. frozen beef exports to Japan, they're actually down 26% after Japan imposed that emergency tariff due to an influx of frozen beef from the U.S. The tariff increased from 38.5% to 50% of the Japanese market to protect domestic producers. Meat industry publication Meeting Place is reporting that Japan's frozen beef imports from the U.S. were 4,317 metric tons in August. That's down 26% year over year. But the U.S. Meat Export Federation says it is possible that some of the August declines were due to additional product being ordered ahead of the duty rate increase. The July to August average was 9,816 metric tons per month, which is almost exactly the same as a year ago. Meanwhile, Japan's August chilled beef imports from the U.S. were 13,721 metric tons. That's up 54% year over year. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
You may see a brief shot on TV's evening news about a wildfire burning somewhere in the U.S., but most people know very little about how destructive these fires are. The Great Plains region of our country is one of the most productive farm regions. It stretches from the Montana on the Canadian border all the way to the Gulf of Mexico in Texas and Louisiana. It's a region that has had numerous wildfires over the last decade. Here's what it looks like. From 1985 to 1995, some 33 tragic fires were recorded. From 2005 to 2014, that number jumped to 117 fires. Now, these fires are more destructive to rangeland and forest land, but there always is a large amount of damage to farmland and grazing land. The tragedy is they're not man-made fires. So I guess we blame it on climate change. And that's Ag Review for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
More than 120 members of the Coalition to Promote U.S. Agricultural Exports are urging leaders of the House Committee on Agriculture to increase funding for USDA export promotion programs in the new Farm Bill. In today's interview segment, Cindy Zimmerman gets more on this push for trade programs. Here's Cindy.
I'm speaking with Mark Powers, who is president of the Northwest Horticultural Council, based in Washington State, and also chairman of the Coalition to Promote U.S. Agricultural Exports. And this coalition came out with press releases in the last week or so regarding promotion for exports, U.S. exports in other countries. So tell me a little bit, first of all, Mark, about the coalition and its goals.
Sure. The coalition is made up of some 150 organizations, basically, that around the United States, representing farmers and ranchers, fishermen, forest product producers, cooperatives, small businesses, quite an amalgamation of organizations that are very interested in exporting U.S. agricultural products around the world. It's been in existence for decades, going back into the late 80s, roughly, with the sole purpose of seeking support and maintaining support for U.S. ag exports, and specifically funding the market access program and also funding the foreign market development program. Both of those are administered by USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service, FAS, and funded through the Farm Bill. The programs are funded through the Farm Bill and utilized by many groups. Anybody that's exporting overseas is probably involved in either one or both of the market development market access program.
All right. Well, as far as the upcoming Farm Bill is concerned, the 2018 Farm Bill, what is your coalition's requesting as far as funding for MAP and FMD in the next Farm Bill?
Well, we're seeking an increase. This isn't something that came out overnight or just out of thin air. We've been working over the past 2 years with members across the United States to look at the justifications and the needs related to the market access program and the foreign market development program. So right now, the MAP program, for short, is funded at $200 million and has been since 2006. And the FMD program is at a level of $34.5 million. We're seeking to double those funds for both programs over the next 5 years of the next Farm Bill, so increasing to $400 million annually for MAP and $69 million annually for FMD.
And you cited a couple of studies that have showed how these programs have paid off for U.S. farmers and ranchers. Tell me a little bit about the what you found, what these studies found.
We're interested in justifying these public expenditures, public resources, of course, and we felt it was important to be able to look at it, solid numbers, econometric studies, for instance, done by economists. And what they found out was that the return on investment of MAP and FMD between 1977 and 2014 was roughly $28 in gains for every dollar spent on foreign market development. So and that's consistent with previous studies that have been done over the years, again, making sure that public funds are going to programs that really do provide public good as well as good to the farmers and ranchers and growers that are out there. what we're seeing is over the years, we've had a decrease in funding based on sequestration, for example, administrative costs, and just overall inflation and depreciation of the U.S. dollar, which adds, we think, roughly almost 30% depreciation. So it's a very positive public-private partnership, but the real purchasing power, if you will, of that money that is provided, matching funds that are provided to MAP and FMD has decreased over the years, and we think it's time to inject more funds into that valuable program.
Well, as far as the importance of these programs to different commodities, we tend to know a lot about corn and soybeans, the importance of exports to those Midwest and larger crops. But what about specialty crops and horticultural crops? How important are these programs to people who grow fruits and vegetables and nuts?
Sure. I did some quick back-of-the-envelope calculations, if you will. I think there are about 35 or 36 different groups in the specialty crop industry that avail themselves of MAP funds. We're not big users of FMD, but we do really focus on MAP. And I think it's about $50 million a year, roughly, that goes to our specialty crop growers. For us, exports are critical. I mean, we export about 30% of what we produce, whether that's apples, pears, or cherries. And as everyone knows, 97% of the world's population is outside of the U.S. I think that number has been widely used. And it really allows us to increase our efficiencies. You know, we're producing not just for the U.S. market. Obviously, the U.S. market is the most important. It's the best high-value dollar-wise market we have. But we export huge volumes to Mexico and Canada, Asia-Pacific. And it just helps the growers to have those additional consumers around the world and getting our product out and about.
Well, how has the current global trade climate made programs like this even more important for agricultural producers?
Currently, obviously, everybody's paying attention to NAFTA and the Korean Free Trade Agreement. I think there's disappointment in the lack of progress in the Asia-Pacific, the demise of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for instance. And with that uncertainty, there are ramifications. Your customers overseas, you know, are looking to other suppliers. Speaking for our commodities, there are other origins, Southern Hemisphere or China, for instance, or the EU. All of them produce apples, pears, and cherries. So it's a very globally competitive industry that we operate in. And these MAP monies help keep our brand, the Pacific Northwest, Washington State apples, for instance, or Northwest cherries, in front of the consumers and in front of the trade, and that's valuable. You know, the Europeans are putting in all kinds of money into their programs. The Chinese have other subsidy programs that assist their tree fruit growers. And so for us, this is a very important, again, public-private partnership where our guys, our growers, put money up and match the federal money and then design their own programs overseas to reach these consumers and others in the trade.
And again, to get more details, agexportscount.org is a great resource. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark Powers, who's serving as chairman of the Coalition to Promote U.S. Agricultural Exports. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
We'll have more on trade on agriculture right after this. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West, and we will be back in just a moment.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers. But these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the Silage Zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West, continuing our coverage of trade and agriculture. Why does trade matter to U.S. Ag? Here's Michael Clements.
Trade is a vital component to the success of U.S. agriculture. USDA figures showed that in 2016, the top 10 export markets for U.S. coarse grains, co-products, ethanol, and meat products were worth more than $7 billion. In part two of the U.S. Grains Council's Trade Focus series, we hear why trade is important for U.S. farmers. Floyd Gabler, the Director of Trade Policy and Biotechnology for the U.S. Grains Council, is a veteran trade policy expert. Gabler has served as Deputy Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He has more than 25 years of experience in trade policy. He says trade brings an overwhelming benefit to the economy.
The value of trade really centers around each country's comparative advantage. You know, we have the ability to produce goods. We have economies of size and scale. U.S. agriculture is a perfect example of that. You know, public-private research and increasing our ag productivity, and obviously our farmers have access and adopt new technology and innovative practices to remain competitive. And those benefits spill down through the value chain. Ultimately, the beneficiary really is the end user, the consumer.
Specifically for agriculture, trade offers a way to move U.S. farm products that farmers produce. Gabler says the majority of U.S. agriculture's customers are not from the United States.
It's the old adage of 95% of U.S. food and agriculture's customers lie outside our borders. And that's going to be the determining factor of whether U.S. agriculture is going to continue to be competitive and financially viable in the future. It really does come down to the fact that if we cannot continue to expand our ability to export, the continued growth and productivity of this sector will decline, and that's going to mean less economic opportunity and viability for the sector as a whole. Agriculture and trade are intricately tied together, and its success or failures is tied to the ability to match those two factors together.
Trade, Gabler says, is a critical component of the farm safety net and supports our national security.
Our ability to export means the difference between having a good year or having a disastrous year, and that plays even more broader into our own national security. I mean, every nation will always demand, as part of national security, the ability to adequately feed and house its people. So food and agriculture are always going to be a bedrock of national security.
In part three of the Trade Focus series, we'll find out what happens in a trade negotiation. Learn more about the importance of trade online at www.grains.org. Michael Clements reporting.
USDA assistance funds to Honduras help increase agricultural productivity, which improves lives for families. And the hope is, will help persuade young people to stay home instead of immigrating in search of some way to make a living. Stephanie Ho has the story.
The Secretary of Agriculture and Livestock for Honduras, Jacobo Paz, says his country has clear goals for how to best use USDA assistance funds.
Corn is one of our main products, because we eat tortillas and 3 times a day. Mark can tell you that. But basically what we want to do with the funds is productivity is a must.
What does he mean by that?
Just to give you an idea, you are getting here like 140 bushels per acre on the average. In corn, we get probably 25% of that as an average. So productivity is a must.
He adds that improvements in agricultural productivity will directly improve lives for many Honduran families.
Agriculture in Honduras is in the hands of a lot of small farmers with less than probably 5 acres, to give you an idea. So anything we do to improve productivity will benefit a family, basically.
He also points to his ministry's efforts to train young people in agriculture to help give them more than just hope for a better future.
Once we have the kids trained, we give them more opportunities to stay there. So they will think twice. Instead of, you know, feeling that they don't have opportunities, they will think twice and they may start their own small business, or they may start working for the farm that belongs to his family and work for another farm's in the area, and that will improve their income so they don't have the need to emigrate to or to the city or to another country.
He was in Washington to report on USDA agricultural assistance provided through the Food for Progress program. In training young people, his ministry, or SAG, provides them with a diploma.
They take the diploma, they take care of it, and they use it in their way looking for jobs. They use the diploma and they say, you know, I have been trained by SEDUCA through the program that USDA has with SAG, and I will be able to help you in the farm to improve productivity.
And he adds the young people who are trained are not strangers to their communities. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.